Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. Joining me is an entrepreneur who did listen to my interviews. And so he gets the goal here, which is to help people who are listening get some ideas, get some inspiration, get some tactics that are stuck in their heads and are available to them when they're ready to use them to build their businesses. One of the things that today's guest noticed that took me a while to really be aware of was that when we're communicating with friends, we are using, I'm going to call them GIFs for now, but GIF is perfectly acceptable too. We're using these animated images as a way of expressing how we feel. Like if somebody does something positive, we might send a crowd cheering. If somebody is, I don't have any great examples of this, but I see them all the time when I communicate with my brother, especially, who must love sending out GIFs. But obviously we see them on Twitter, we see them on Facebook, we see them all over. And today's guest said, you know, this is a new way of expressing, this is a new way for people to express themselves. And he ended up creating a company whose goal is to enable us to use GIFs to express ourselves on the platforms that we love. On iPhones, on Twitter, et cetera. His name is David McIntosh. He created a company called Tenor, and he sold this GIF search engine and database to Google. And I invited him here to talk about how he did it. We could do it thanks to two phenomenal sponsors. The first is a company called ClickFunnels, and they don't even want you to know that you can get great landing pages from them. They just want you to know if you like this podcast and you want to find out how you can grow your traffic, there's a podcast that you can listen to as a follow-up. It's called Traffic Secrets. And the second is a company that you know me talking about it for years. It's called TopTal for hiring developers. I'll talk about those later. First, David, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I kept looking for speculation about how much you sold for, and I know that those numbers are always off or usually off, but I didn't even find that. How much did you sell the company to Google for?
Yeah, we obviously can't speak to the details of the deal, but you know, we obviously you can find information online around the trajectory of the business and you know how we were doing beforehand and so forth. And so, I guess
you were the number one keyboard, weren't you, at the time?
Yeah, I
mean, sharing GIFs.
Yeah, a fantastic amount of scale that we had. You know, we had in the business.
And you were built into which other platforms?
You can use Tenor in most major messaging apps. So not only can you use the iOS keyboard that we built, but you can find Tenor in everything from Facebook to WhatsApp to Twitter and many other messaging and communication platforms.
Do you remember the day that the deal went through?
I do. Yeah. It was actually great because I remember I was sitting there at the kitchen table with my wife, and you know, we were doing a final call to close it. And so it was kind of fun having my wife at my side as we were completing the transaction that morning. So yeah, I remember it very well.
And what did it mean for you? Like, did you look at it and say, all right, now I've made it, now I can take a break? Nothing, did it?
No, yeah, I've been busier in the last 2 years, perhaps compared to any other time before. I think for me, it was really a continuation of the mission and the journey. You know, as you mentioned at the beginning, we really had this mission around how do we help people better express themselves? And so it was really a continuation of, how do we continue to improve that product? How do we continue to scale it? How do we make it easier for everybody on the planet, everybody who has a mobile phone, everybody who's communicating?
That's what it meant for you, that this sale didn't mean I get to take a breath, I get to like feel a sense of big accomplishment, I get to buy something. It's I get to enable people to share GIFs.
Well, it, you know, I would say more broadly, not just share GIFs. The broader vision is around visual expression. More generally, I guess what I would say is that after a certain period of time, the mission really does become more important than all other you know, attributes. Obviously,
why this mission? The only thing I can think of, and by the way, we usually send microphones to all of our guests, but, and you're probably going to get one tomorrow or something from Amazon, but because of Amazon's issues around COVID-19, delivery didn't make it to you. But as you talk, just watch out, because when you move, your mic is brushing up against your shirt, the mic from your headset. The only thing that I'm trying to understand then why you care that much. And what I'm flashing to is something you told our producer about how you did some speech and debate when you were growing up and you came away a little disillusioned. Can you talk about what you were doing and why you felt that disillusion?
Yeah, well, I guess backing up, my interest in technology started when I was interning at a supercomputing center at UCSD. And so I was working on clustering software, which helped run these various computing platforms at scale. And that led me to Berkeley, and then that led me to experimenting with a variety of different web applications, consumer services, and that ultimately led, you know, all the way to Tenor, which I can describe. But I had also been active in speech and debate in high school, and I liked the intellectual element of it. But there was sort of a moment I remember at Berkeley where I was choosing, do I really want to double down on the technology aspect, or do I want to, you know, perhaps focus on speech and debate, and ultimately, you know, take a career in law? And I was just struck by how, with technology, you were actually building something, you were shipping something, you were having, you know, impact on the world. And so for me personally, even though I really loved the intellectual rigor of speech and debate, it felt like at the end of that, you know, you could go back and forth, and you know, who knew which person was right. But at least with technology, you could get to a point where you were building something that definitely did have an impact. So there was an element of absolute truth to that, versus speech and debate, where it was fun, definitely intellectually rigorous. But there's not, you know, I was having difficulty seeing, well, where's the actual final impact? How am I impacting the world or consumers or, you know, other people by arguing with other people in a room for a couple hours.
That makes sense. I remember that as a kid. I used to think that debate was about coming to the best possible conclusion. And then I realized, no, it's about whoever is the best speaker wins. And it's no longer about truth. It's no longer about anything other than an arms race of intellectual power, firepower. And then you feel like, all right, I've got to have this. But it also feels, you know, kind of sad that it's not the truth that wins, but it's the best speaker that wins. So is that partially why you care? Am I making too much of a connection there between you trying to pursue truth and meaningful communication back then, and now through Tenor saying this is the way to enable people to communicate? Or am I drawing too much of a conclusion there?
Well, I think the connection is definitely there, that I was looking for how to build services at scale that would impact a lot of people. So that connection was definitely there, but the way that I ended up there was through a lot of twists and turns.
Okay.
And so, you know, initially, what I worked on was a company called Redux. And by the way, you know, many of the early people I worked with there and the board members ended up coming on, you know, to the Tenor journey as well. But that was much more focused on video in a connected TV context. And so the premise there was we had built some really interesting recommendation technology. And more people were buying connected TVs. This was back in, you know, 2010, 2011. And they were using Netflix for movies and Hulu for TV shows. But there was this gap in the middle around how do you help people consume online video, YouTube-like content, UGC-like content, but more of a lean-back context. And so we built this experience that functioned somewhat like the TV that we're all used to, which is linear programming. You could switch through channels, but it was programmed with online content from influencers, from your friends, from interesting brands. And so we'd assemble these channels that, you know, people would watch for 30, 40, 50 minutes. And it was in doing that that I met on a panel on the future of video, my future co-founder, Eric, in Tenor. And at the time he was running a business called, Metacafe. He had joined a little bit after the acquisition of YouTube to build a new business around, online video. And so, you know, we had coffee afterwards and kept talking. And at one point we even thought about, in the way that whether we'd merge the, you know, the Redux business and the Meta Cafe business and put them together. And as Eric and I built a relationship, you know, Eric really started to push us on how would we reinvent video around the mobile experience? Because at the time, obviously, you had video experiences that were big on mobile, like YouTube, for example, big web presence at the time. And so you were able to translate that into a successful mobile experience.
And by the way, from what I remember about Meta Cafe, what they did was it was trying to be a more professional YouTube, partnering up with producers, partnering up with brands, where at the time YouTube was anyone can post whatever you want, and we're going to give the middle finger to brands, to the big content companies because they have to accept the new world. I lost you at middle finger. I wouldn't say that, but they would just go do your own thing, where Meta Cafe said, let's partner together and create something more meaningful, right?
Yeah. At the time, Meta Cafe was focused more on professional content, which is, you know, yeah. I think partially why we had mutual right. interests, because at Redux, we were thinking about these sort of curated lean back channels, uh-huh. which ultimately meant that the experience did feel more professional. It was still shorter content weaved together. Yep. You know, was a little bit higher finish.
Very similar worldviews. And then you met up at a panel, you ended up working together, but before you did, you each had to kind of close out your past to move to your future. What happened to Redux?
So we both ended up selling our companies to different acquirers. And so that's when we came together and said, well, you know, what if we did another, what if we did a company together? And obviously both of us had this interest in video. We said, well, what if we reinvent video around the mobile experience? Mobile is the biggest platform. Mobile is still very, you know, growing very quickly. What would that look like if we started a video company focused on mobile? And, you know, you had Vine at the time and other properties like that, but they hadn't really hit mainstream, massive scale. They'd sort of, you know, pop a couple million users, maybe 10 million users, but nothing hundreds of millions of users or a billion users in scale. And so the key insight at the beginning was we said, all right, well, you know, video on mobile is short, video on mobile probably needs to be shareable. So we built this app that let people create GIFs out of videos, pictures, other forms of content. Launched that, got a couple hundred thousand downloads, some modest success, started to build a library of this content. But the problem was that it was still too difficult for users to share this content because, to your point, they're in a messenger. They've got to leave the messenger. They've got to open this app. They've got to find the content. They've then got to share it back. It took 2 to 3 minutes. It was kind of challenging.
And the company Redux created a product called Riffsy, right? Riffsy, from what I understand, your goal was to find a way for people to talk about the videos that you care about and that you guys are helping to popularize by taking short clips that are in GIF format and share them. It was like a way of getting more people to share the videos that you were creating, right?
Yeah. So that's the creation app that I'm referring to.
Uh-huh. Kind of spun off after the sale. You got to keep on owning Riffsy. I think you had about $1 million in venture funding that went along with this spinoff, right? You got to keep $1 million of it.
Raised separately.
So we
raised this sort of brand new entity, brand new company, different, you know, investors that came in and put in the money. And so that was the initial product where we focused on this creation element. And you know, what we quickly discovered is that the creation piece worked, but the sharing piece was too difficult. And actually, I remember talking to some of the users. We'd actually call up users that were using the product, and someone said, "Hey, you know, what if this were in the keyboard? You know, I use emoji all the time, right? I'm using the emoji keyboard on iOS. What if we're in the keyboard? Wouldn't that be cool?" And at the time, I said, "Yeah, that would be amazing, but we can't build that product." You know, at the time, iOS didn't have a keyboard platform. But then, fast forward, this is maybe, you know, 6 months later, I remember Apple had a developer, I think it was a conference, live stream in the summer. This was like maybe June of 2014-ish. So I go to my computer, I'm checking the news, and lo and behold, I see, oh, Apple announced this keyboard platform. Light bulb immediately went off. I said, wow, like this is going to solve all the problems that we have with the business, which is we know that people fundamentally want to communicate visually, but it's just too difficult to do. So there's too many steps. And so this platform allows us now to make this experience available at the point of input when people are communicating. They can sort of natively access and search from the messaging experience. And so later that afternoon, I dug into the announcement and looked for clues around, okay, like, can I do everything I want to do here, right? Because I didn't know at the time, well, would the keyboard environment be able to actually support animated GIFs? Like, are there going to be memory constraints? Are there all types of, technical hurdles? And so over the next couple months, we developed what became the GIF keyboard, which was a way for somebody to easily search for and share into iMessage. I remember we seeded the app with people beforehand. So we created a beta build, and I did a pre-interview with Ryan Lawler. I had known Ryan Lawler at TechCrunch from the Redux days. He had written a lot about the work that we were doing in connected TV. And so we got together at a coffee shop in the Mission in San Francisco, I think it was on a weekend, and showed him the experience. He immediately loved it, wanted the product for himself. So I got him a beta build, and what was intriguing is that in the week up to launch, right, because you in this case with a brand new feature to iOS, you couldn't actually launch it until the new OS rolled out. This was iOS 8, right? So we sort of had to wait, week and a half, 2 weeks for that OS to go out. What I found is that link where I set up a beta build started to go a little bit viral. People, who I had never, sent the build to got access. And I recall actually there was this funny tweet from Om Malik, where he said something like, the brightest minds used to be working on ads and they're now working on GIF keyboards. And he included a link, to that, to that private page that I had set up, for the application. And so, based on the early user feedback, but also the fact that this page sort of started to go viral within a small community, we had a pretty good sense that we had really cracked a core problem here, which is that people fundamentally wanted to communicate more visually, but prior to Tenor, it was just too difficult to do so. So Ryan wrote an article in TechCrunch, which published maybe 12 or 15 hours after the app was available, within the store. And from there it went mainstream and went viral. I think we had, millions of downloads within the first, 2 to 3 months.
I'm curious about how you understood that GIFs were the way that people were going to express themselves. It started out as just a way of you turning your long form video into viral snippets. That little realization, you're saying, did it come from people reaching out to you and saying, I need an easier way to share this because I want to communicate, or what?
Well, GIFs had been a format on the web for, almost 2 decades, right? And you started to see a resurgence of the format, to your point, on Tumblr, where, people were starting to use the GIF as a moment, of a broader, piece of content. What I saw is that people were using emoji quite a bit on the device. And so people were clearly looking for a way to more visually express themselves. Mm-hmm. And there was some usage of GIFs on messaging. Apple had actually built support for the GIF format in iMessage maybe, a year and a half, two years prior. But what's crazy is, the GIF format had baked into the MMS protocol, a decade plus prior. So you could theoretically even send a GIF to somebody with a feature phone and, it'd still work. It wouldn't necessarily be auto animating, but there was broad support, for this format. And so I had observed that, yes, there was this inherent desire for people to express themselves more visually. This format had been around for a while, but what was really missing was an easy way to be able to access this format, search this format, find the right thing in this expression context when you want to actually communicate. And so I think this was a you know, my view on consumer in general is that most big consumer innovations are driven by a reduction in friction. There's fundamentally a behavior that users really want to do, but it's just a little bit too difficult to do it. And I think with non-digital goods and services, it's far easier to observe this friction. What we forget in digital services is that often a very small reduction in friction can have a massive compounding effect over time in the business. And so really focusing on what is the core proposition, how do you make it better, how do you continue to iterate on that, how do you make those gains compound over time, you could end up with a really massively different outcome. So if you think about GIFs prior to Tenor, I would estimate maybe 1 million, 2 million people were sharing them in the world on a monthly basis in messaging. But by making it just a little bit easier, by taking that 2 to 3 minute process and making it 20 to 30 seconds, we were able to multiply the number of people who were able to do this by two orders of magnitude.
You know what? What you said about reducing friction for consumers is really insightful. It's one of the big things that I'm going to take away from this conversation, that with consumers, you see what they do that is, or they, what they're trying to do that has too much friction, too many barriers. And if you could reduce the friction, you've got a product that they obviously want because they're showing that they're willing to go through all those hurdles to get it. But then I'm looking at my notes here, and I could have sworn that you told our producer that the challenge you had with consumer-facing companies, which you, I think, told her was the hardest thing to take on, is that there's hardly ever an obvious solution that you're providing and that it's ambiguous. And I've noticed that, too, in interviewing entrepreneurs here, that with enterprise, it's so clear. They tell you what they want. There's a clear rationale. With even SMB, small, medium-sized businesses, there's some of that. How do you square the thought of consumers are doing things, we need to eliminate the friction, that's how we win, with it's not obvious what we need to create?
Yeah, I think the solving friction is always easier in hindsight, right? It's always easier to in hindsight say, wow, users really wanted to do this thing. We made it just easier to do it. So I think the process of getting there often involves a lot of twists and in turns. Mm-hmm. But I think these insights are out there. So if you think about the Instagram story, for example. Instagram didn't invent filters. With Instagram, they didn't even need to believe that filters would be a popular behavior. There are apps like Hipstamatic and a few others that had already surged to the top of the charts, and we're seeing tremendous amounts of consumer adoption. And so in that case, there's clear consumer demand to make your photos look better on mobile devices. The insight they applied is they said, well, people don't want to just transactionally take a photo, add a filter to it, and share it to Facebook. Maybe there's a whole new role for a network built from the ground up around photos on your mobile device. We then transform in some way to make really attractive for consumption. And so that consumer pain in some ways was hiding in plain sight. Right? What they did is they took an existing thing that worked. They made it free. Hipstamatic and the others, I think, were 99 cents or 199 or something like that. Made it free. And then the payment, so to speak, from consumers was you had to sign up, you had to create a profile. And that's how they bootstrap the network. So I think that the challenge with consumer is that it is often harder to pinpoint what these pains are at first. And once you solve one of these pains, the big risks is, will it scale? And like with an enterprise business, if you have, 5,000 customers, 10,000 customers, you typically have a pretty interesting business if you're charging $100,000, $500,000, $1 million, for your solution. But with consumer, you need it to scale, not just to 1 million users, not just to 10 million users. It has to scale to hundreds of millions of users to be a really big business. And so that's the second half of the challenge, which is you need to believe that the behavior that you've uncovered, the way that you're reducing friction, ultimately makes the service useful to hundreds of millions, if not billions of people around the world.
I hope I'm not being obtuse here as I ask this follow-up question, but it seems like, especially if you're looking at the example of Instagram, you're saying, look for that initial, the initial barrier that that's blocking them from doing what they want. And maybe in their case, Hipstamatic was charging a few pennies. And so that was a barrier, and remove that. Then look for the next barrier. And that is, well, it's too much of a pain to move from Instagram into Facebook. What if it was just built in and they could just share it within there? Is that the answer? And is that what you were doing too? Or am I missing your point?
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, we looked for, I think about it as every big business is a series of wedges that you stack on top of each other. It's a series of insights. And so In Tenor's case, the first insight was the right injection point was through the keyboard. That's how we could build a scaled consumer experience where We could get consumers coming in to search for this content. What did that do? Well, that let us build a great search engine, and it let us also start to build a great content library because we could partner with all the movie studios, television companies, have them contribute.
Well, it let you, or was it that at each step, you noticed another friction point and you had to eliminate it? Was it that, all right, we got the keyboard, but now people need to have a better search? All right, we got a better search, but what people are looking for is not some random dude, but they want to express themselves using what happened on HBO last night. And so let's partner. Well, they have all this, but installing a keyboard is really hard for people. What if we could bake it into the apps they already use, like Twitter? Am I understanding that right? Or am I in hindsight adding?
It's a little bit of both, which is we knew that we needed a way to light the ecosystem on fire. If you didn't have existing scale, none of the movies and movie studios and television partners would want to work with you. So you needed some existing scale. But of course, if you didn't have enough content, how could you bootstrap with consumers? So you needed some strategy to be able to initially light up the network. And so that's what that launch did. That gave us the injection point to light up the network. And then as you described, the next phase of business was to say, okay, well, how can we reduce friction even further? Well, we can reduce friction by bringing this experience natively into messengers, communication apps, operating system level integrations. And so that first phase of the business, in a sense, was building a viral consumer-facing property that let us build excellence in search as well as content. And then that led to the second phase of the business where we're able to then go and integrate more natively into thousands of different communication services.
You know, and the integration part is something a past guest of mine sent me a note afterwards and said, Andrew, what you always miss is integration is so much bigger than how do you get people to notice you? How do you buy an ad here? If you could integrate in, he said, look, for example, people don't know it, but we grew really fast, he told me, and he runs a service that tweaks people's WordPress installations and improves it for businesses without having them understand how WordPress works. He says the only way we grew was WordPress started sending people to us. Other hosting companies started sending their people to us, and we became their back end. And that was a flood of real customers that are paying, and you can't buy enough ads to do that for many businesses. All right, let me take a moment and talk about how to get traffic. There is a book called Traffic Secrets. I interviewed the author, Russell Brunson, about it. And I said, look, Russell, you've created these landing pages for years. You created software that creates landing pages for other people. No wonder you wrote a book that actually encapsulates what it takes to get people to come to your site and to convert into being buyers. And he said, yeah, but you know, Andrew, a lot of people aren't going to read my book right off the bat. And he told me that he's got a podcast where what he's doing is taking some of the key ideas from his book about how to get traffic and turning them into a podcast. If you're listening to me and you're looking to get traffic, even if it's not paid traffic, in fact, especially right now in this environment, he's going to show you how you can get traffic to your site, get people to try your product. All you have to do is listen to his podcast. He'll tell you some of the stories from his book. The guy's got experience having done this through ClickFunnels for his business. And also, like I said, creating software that creates landing pages for some of the best marketers out there. So I'm not telling you to buy anything. I'm just telling you at the end of this interview, if you want to learn how to get more people to check out your stuff, go sign up to Traffic Secrets Podcast in whatever tool you're listening to this on. I keep going back and forth. My podcast app right now, it's Slack. No, wait, not Slack. What is it? Why do I keep calling it Slack? Spotify and the podcast app. Do you listen to podcasts? What do you listen to them in?
I've been more recently getting into various financial related podcasts. Mm-hmm. So if you give me a moment, I can actually pull up. I had bookmarked this on Twitter. Let's see.
I also listen on my Echo speakers throughout the house, which I don't even want to say the name of the assistant on that, so I don't trigger it, but I listen on that. Yeah. What's the podcast you're listening to?
This particular one was called Inflation, Deflation, Which One Is It? With Jeff Booth, author of The Price of Tomorrow, the Investors Podcast.
Why are you interested in finance podcasts right now?
I don't know. It's an area that I've never spent that much time thinking about. Obviously I have an economics background. And so it's just, you know, interesting, especially in these times with a lot more, volatility and uncertainty to, you know, get a better understanding of the financial systems, but also get a sense of, you know, how other people are thinking about it. Since I think so much of the market is psychological. So mm-hmm. it's helpful to get an understanding of just, you know, how other people in the world are thinking through their next move.
I wonder if you thought about this. I keep thinking, what's the disaster moment? Let's think about that and be prepared for that, right? And the easy one is, well, we can't get food from the grocery store. Let's go stock up. Everyone's doing that. But that's not the real disaster moment. I don't think we're going to get to that point. It's like, what happens if our money isn't worth what it used to be? How many times do you see in history people who saved up a lot of money and then the value of their money went away, right? That's something that I've been thinking a little bit about. What do you think? What's the disaster moment? How do you deal with it?
Yeah, I mean, especially now, it's a good question with with everything that's happening around, you know, COVID. Mm-hmm. I think if you're doing a venture backed high growth business, I think it's really challenging to focus on, like I said, it's a long tail events, right? Because ultimately, the biggest challenge in front of you is how do you get to critical mass? How do you get to scale? How do you continue scaling the business? So I'm a big believer that you can't think too much about things that you can't directly control. I remember one of our investors in Redux, Gilman Louie, had this quote where he would sort of cite race car drivers, and he'd say, all right, well, you know, successful Formula drivers, when there's a crash in front of them, you don't focus on the crash. If you focus on the crash, if you get really locked up on the crash, you're going to run right into the crash.
Yeah.
Always focus around the way out of it, the way around it. Like, focus on where you want to be. And so obviously it's not specific advice, but I think that's a general, you know, principle, which is situations like this, you don't want to concentrate on the mess in front of you. You want to concentrate on, well, what's the path to get around it? Where do I want to be? And then I also think focus helps, right? Like, if you think about one of the, you know, the key takeaways from our story is, we really focused on the underlying levers that drove the business. You know, like if you came to our office, back in the day, we didn't even have our name on the door. We didn't care. I remember, you know, we invited our investors to come by, and I said, hey, you know, it'd be great if we got to 1 billion users just in this office with this team, with this small number of people. We were really a big believer that by building the right product, by building the right technology, we would get a tremendous amount of leverage. And so, you know, we didn't measure our success in terms of the size of the office, how many people we had in the office. We really measured success by how many consumers are we serving, what kind of impact are we driving, what's the quality of the service. So I think, especially in times like these with volatility, that laser-like focus on what really matters, that ultimately serves you well.
That understanding that if you focus on the crash, you're going to be a part of the crash because you're naturally going to steer into the crash. It's called target fixation. My brother, who used to ride a motorcycle, would send me videos of motorcycle riders who are clearly looking at the direction of something that they could potentially crash into. And because they were paying attention to the danger too much, they'd crash right into it. And I get it. I want to know a little bit more about the levers, but we talked earlier about how iOS 8, I think it was, enabled you to create a keyboard that had GIFs in them so people could share directly from anywhere where they could share a keyboard virtually. But Apple rejected your keyboard. Why did they reject your keyboard when you put it together and submitted it to the App Store?
Yeah, it was pretty unexpected. Basically, the initial rejection was around the fact that Apple didn't actually expect this type of keyboard. You know, when they put out the platform, they were imagining that you'd have keyboards like SwiftKey, for example, where, you know, people are, you know, getting an alternate keyboard. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. They weren't anticipating this visual use case, which ended up becoming, by the way, the biggest use case in the third party ecosystem. And so initially, the feedback was you need a real keyboard in the experience. And so when we got that feedback, we're like, well, this doesn't make sense. We don't want you to use this as a real keyboard. This is right. supposed to be something where you'd switch to it, you'd share the GIF, and you'd switch back to your normal, Apple keyboard. But we were really under the clock because, I think we got this rejection notice. Maybe it was like Sunday. I think it was Monday morning. And the OS was starting to roll out later that week. And so I remember I was still working in the code base at the time of the product. And, I got to the office early in the morning and didn't even eat lunch and basically said, okay, I'm going to build a very simple, QWERTY keyboard to satisfy this requirement. And I'm not going to go anywhere, until I get it done. So, I spent, 6 or 7 hours building a very, very, very basic, QWERTY keyboard just to satisfy the requirements. And then you could switch between the two modes. You have the GIF mode and that keyboard mode, and submitted it to Apple. Went through, which is great. And so it was kind of surprising, and that's the thing. The things that come up at the last moment, you never really expect. And you have to be sort of nimble.
You also helped me understand why so many keyboards that I used have crappy, like ordinary QWERTY keyboards included in them. Like I use the app Copied, which lets me, whatever it is that I copy on my screen, automatically it saves it into the Copy app. And then through the keyboard, I can just paste it in. And their keyboard for typing, regular letters is kind of bad. It's a little bit buggy. Sometimes it locks up on my screen. I didn't understand why they would even ever need it. I could type using the regular keyboard. Now I understand Apple required it. What about Android though? You keep saying that the inflection point was the keyboard, the third-party keyboards coming into iOS. I remember as an iOS user envying Android people for being able to add whatever keyboard they wanted and wish that Apple would do it. Couldn't you guys have done it on Android? Didn't you guys do it on Android?
We did. Yeah, we tried. And there were two problems that we ran into. The first mm-hmm. was that we didn't actually want to be a keyboard company and build a full keyboard. And on Apple, there was this nice dynamic where you could easily hold down on the globe and switch between keyboards. So it was perfectly designed for, I'm using my normal system keyboard. I want to share a GIF. I switch to it. I share it. I go back.
Versus on Android, what was the switching like?
With Android, you basically would install a keyboard and stick with that keyboard. It wasn't set up for people to switch between these keyboards because it was much more of an ecosystem designed around like any developer, any right. Partner build a keyboard. So that was the first problem. The second problem, this was the more fundamental one, is that at the time there wasn't what's called image keyboard support. So you couldn't actually share the image into a messenger. You could share a link, but not the image. And when we tested this product, we found that it was really unsatisfying to consumers. They get excited about the prospect of this product, but then when they actually used it and they tapped the GIF and it put a link into the message, you could see the disappointment on their face. Like, oh, yeah. This isn't what I wanted. And so the first question would be like, well, how can I get the image, in the message? And so you could see the viral loop breaking right there, which is that somebody could tell their friend to get this product, the friend would get the product, but then when it came to actually sharing, they wouldn't make it past that step. And that was a really key part of how this product spread, which is that people often notice changes in behavior of their friends. So, I think we think that viral products spread because of viral invites and flows and links and so forth. And at some level, a tactical level, maybe that's true. But really what's happening is that people notice changes in behavior of their friends. And if it's an interesting change of behavior, they'll say, well, how did you do that? I want to do the same thing. And so what happened in our product is that it's not that somebody perhaps never shared a GIF before, and this was the first time that they shared a GIF. It's that when they were messaging their friends would be responding so quickly with GIFs and they'd be sharing more GIFs. And so that was the change that people notice, and they say, whoa, how are you doing that? I want to do that too. And that's how the product would spread. And so with the link, that just didn't happen. because the person wouldn't want to send the link. And if they did send the link, the person on the other end wouldn't want to click on it because they wouldn't get that immediate understanding of what the other person was trying to say. Now, obviously, all that's been fixed. And, you know, of course, Tenor's integrated in a bunch of different large Android applications and so forth. So that, you know, the ecosystem's in a much different place today. But in terms of why we initially launched on iOS in 2014, it was because of that constraint.
All right. I want to come back and ask you about how you knew to start partnering up with other companies. You know what? Let me just hang on this for a moment. I always wondered about that. I thought maybe what you were doing was somehow attaching the Tenor logo to GIFs, but I don't think I'd ever seen a Tenor logo attached to a GIF the way I might with some of your competitors. And I don't think at the time Apple told me that my friend was using a Tenor keyboard to share a GIF. So you're telling me that the way the Tenor spread was my brother might have sent me a GIF and then another and another, and I would have had to ask him, what did you use? And then he'd have to figure out how to go and get it from the App Store or tell me, go find the keyboard at the App Store. Is that right?
Yeah, we did experiment with watermarking early on. But what we found is that actually damaged virality and consumers didn't like it. And so you would end up with an experience that, wasn't great. Consumers didn't love. And also it wouldn't grow as quickly in the long run, because people were less likely to want to share this content if it had a watermark on top of it. The core viral loop was you'd send these things to friends and they'd say, well, how are you doing that? You tell them, oh, I'm using GIF keyboard, Tenor's GIF keyboard. They go, you know, and then grab the app. Since then, you know, if you think about iMessage now, there's things in the platform where there will actually be linkable text sometimes below the GIF. So it'll have a link where you can, you know, go to the App Store. And so there's been other innovations since then that make it easier for people to go and get the application. And of course, when we're natively integrated, then all a person has to do is say, oh, we'll just, you know, tap on the GIF button, then search Tenor, right? And so it's a little bit easier from a discoverability standpoint. But at the very beginning, the viral loop was simply, you know, people noticing the change in behavior and then telling
them
to go get the service. Yeah.
That's unbelievable. Isn't it? You're not like, that's shocking that the product is so good and so basic that people would go out of their way to find out. Or as you mentioned earlier, I guess Omar Malik is a venture capitalist, but also known for having a reporter background. Reporters were starting to spread it before it even officially launched. That's what you created.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing to see when we launched. It was an amazing moment, to see it really rise in the charts and catch on. So I think in hindsight, when we look back, right, that initial launch that we had was ultimately just a fraction of the scale that grew in the years to come. And so, I would say at some level, you sort of become numb to the scale, right? I mean, it's like as we're recounting the story now, it is sort of amazing now to think, wow, just how ubiquitous the service has become, how this has just become a part of our daily behavior, our daily life. But, you know, there is sort of this thing where, my belief is that you always have to be 10xing. You always have to be looking at, well, what's the next big order of magnitude? What's the next big inflection point in thinking about that? So along the way, we were always very focused on, all right, we got to this level of scale. That's fantastic. You know, let's celebrate that for a moment. But the very next moment we'd be thinking about, and okay, well, what's the plan? You know, what's the plan to go to another 10X? How do we bring this to even more people? How do we make the product even more useful?
I noticed in my notes from our producer, Ari Desarmo, 10X kept showing up. And I've got to come back and ask you whether that became an obsession or a source of frustration that you had to keep finding ways to 10X. But I'll quickly tell people, I'm going to highlight something that you guys might have even noticed that happened. David McIntosh, you're listening to right now, had an issue where he needed to create a keyboard for an iOS product that he was launching, like a standard QWERTY keyboard. And he sat down, I think, David, you said 6 hours in order to create that thing?
That's a QWERTY keyboard, yeah.
Yeah. That's the power of a 10X developer, a 10X mind. The reason that I'm bringing this up in the context of my sponsor, TopTal, is what TopTal has is developers who can work that quickly, think that deeply and fast, and often have created the same solution that you are looking for, have played in the same field that you're looking to play in. And that's the beauty of working with top talent. You get top talent available right to you. And so I remember a few weeks ago, I interviewed Noah Kagan. His whole thing is that he keeps telling people, stop your expenses, scale things down. We're going into a bad recession. You have to be prepared for this. And I thought, oh no, and I've got this top talent ad that I'm going to do in the middle of this guy telling everyone to cut back. He's going to just dump on what I'm saying. Instead, he said, no, I've hired from top talent. I said, why? I thought you want to like cut back. He said, what I love about hiring from top talent is it's kind of like Amazon Web Services, where you could just quickly scale up all the developer needs that you need and then quickly scale down when you don't need it anymore. You don't have to onboard them for a long time. You don't have to make sure that they get all the health insurance and everything else that you need in order to get somebody up on your team. And then when it's time to let them go, you don't have to go through this whole process of letting them go. It's quick developers available to you fast that you can scale up quickly and then also scale down as you need. If you haven't talked to TopTal yet, I'm telling you, there's no obligation, but if you go to toptal.com/mixergy, hit that big button, you'll set up a call and you'll get to talk to them about how you can hire. And if you decide to hire from them, you'll see on that page, they've got an incredible deal just for Mixergy listeners because it's created by Mixergy fans. It's toptal.com/mixergy to get 80 hours of developer credit for free when you pay for your first 80 hours. toptal.com/mixergy, toptal.com/mixergy. 10X, meaning, did you sit there all the time thinking, how do we 10X this? How do we go bigger? How do we go bigger? And was that an obsession or was that a source of frustration that you had to keep thinking that way?
Yeah, that was definitely our mindset, which is what's the next big opportunity that we can tackle, right? Because going back to the sort of beginning, we talked about consumer opportunities, to build a really meaningful consumer company, you have to be touching hundreds of millions of people, if not billions of people. So you have to figure out how you crack the next layer of distribution and scale for your business. In our case, we did that by really focusing on the core levers of the business. And we were a very analytically engineering driven organization. So an example, even our BD team, for example, was running SQL queries and doing analysis to figure out, what partners do we focus on? How do we, up-level, the integrations where we're working with existing partners? And so, we really focused in our case on the quality of search because we realized in that viral funnel that I described, the more likely you were to find the perfect GIF, the more likely you were to actually send that to somebody else, the more likely that person was to say, well, how did you do that? And then look to find their own GIF. And then, cycle continued, right? So at the very center of that, you had this experience where how could you, for a given intent, a given thought, feeling, emotion at the back of someone's head, match that to a visual object that helped people express themselves? And so if you could make that core engine better, you would compound that viral adoption process. So it wasn't that when we would say, hey, we've got a 10X, we said, well, let's come up with 10 totally random ideas that are disconnected from the core product. It was always looking for what are ways that we could extend what we've built, build on top of it, and in a way that lets us ultimately accelerate faster.
And I was going to go into partners next, but search, I think, is something we should spend a little time on because it's obvious now to say, if somebody can search for the right GIF, they find it, they could share it, terrific. They're more likely to continue this loop that you've created. How did you notice that at the time? Were you watching people? Were you bringing them into your office here in San Francisco?
Yeah, we had an early version of the prototype that we took out with us. I remember we went to a place with a great Taco Tuesday, and we had the phone with us, and we'd show it to people and get feedback, and we'd look at where are they getting stuck along the way. And so you definitely got feedback early on. In terms of search, what's funny is we almost didn't ship search in the product. We were running out of time. We wanted to get the product out there. And one of the engineers on our team was able to get it working relatively quickly. And so we were able to actually go live with search. And good thing we did because we found that the most retained users coming back to the app over and over again, were coming to search. And so initially people might share from trending or reactions that we had, so that they could figure out, okay, what is this experience like? You know, and part of it was, you know, people didn't know that you could search for emotions before. That was a brand new thing. Like, people weren't going and just typing in happy or smile into traditional search engines. And so, you know, the trending and the reaction tags that we had were part of that training process. But once people got that, the most engaged people were coming back to search. And so that was sort of when that second light bulb went off, and we said, oh, really? What's at the center of this business is search. How do we match this intent to express yourself to a visual object? And of course, that insight didn't happen right after launch, but as we studied usage of the product within a couple months, we had a pretty good sense that search was really a core part of the experience.
And you know what? And now I understand too. I'm going through your product as we're talking about it. I understand now how, like, you're suggesting that I can share awe, you know, A-W-W-W, like, oh, that's so cute or so amazing. I wouldn't have known to search for it. Just knowing that I could, that it's there, means I can start searching for feelings like that. Where did you get the GIFs?
The initial library was originally bootstrapped from that creation app that I mentioned, the initial app called, you know, RiffC. So that built up the initial library. And one of our core principles at the very beginning was that we wanted content to be purpose-built for this use case. So we didn't believe that you could, you know, go and index the web and so forth for this content, but like, that content was created for a different purpose. And so we believe that you would need to create a new content ecosystem from scratch that would serve this expressive use case. And so what we then started to see was the studios, like movie studios, the television companies, all these professional creators wanted to participate in this ecosystem. I remember we got a call from somebody who was working with Taken 3. It was the studio associated with, you know, Taken 3, the Liam Neeson movie. Mm-hmm. And Tenor was going viral in their office, and they said, how do we become part of this? You know, we've got this new movie that we're launching. You know, can we do something interesting? And so our first inclination was just to take GIFs from the trailer and surface them in the product. But what we found was that the moments that help people express themselves, the moments associated with emotion, were the most successful. So for example, there was this moment where Liam Neeson was jumping out of a window and you had YOLO flashing on the screen. That was super successful because people could then use that moment and send it to somebody else. And so the library is effectively this mapping of the world's cultural moments to this metadata that helps understand where people want to use, how people want to use these moments to express themselves.
And was Taken a sponsor the way that Dunkin' Donuts was?
That's right. Yeah,
they were. So, okay. Was that meaningful later, revenue? Sponsorship?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to talk specifically about the metrics, but at a high level, I would say what we really built was a platform that would drive lots of scale to brand partners, and so it worked really well for movies and television companies, obviously, because they were in the business of creating cultural moments. But it also worked really well for advertisers that were in the business of creating cultural moments. Right? Like, you think a lot of advertisers on TV, what are they doing? They're, you know, they have ads that are trying to become part of culture in some way.
Yeah.
And so the platform, you know, is a really interesting way of letting people participate who are ultimately in those businesses of creating cultural moments.
You talked a lot about 10x. You talked a lot about, with our producer, you said billions of users is what you wanted. You were inspired by WhatsApp and how big they got. We talked earlier about how Instagram couldn't just enable you to share on Facebook. They needed to eventually move on to create their own sharing platform. I wonder, why didn't you ever say, look, communication on iMessage and Facebook Messenger all happens via text. Why bolt our thing on it instead of saying there's a new way to communicate? We'll create our own chat app. Why didn't you go to that?
Well, I think we always from the beginning saw this as more of a layer on the communication ecosystem. We didn't really see it as a standalone messenger. We saw this much more as like a service, as a language that people would ultimately want to tap into and become, ubiquitous. And so it was just a different, I think it was just a different, vision and mission. I think when you're, you're building a messenger, trying to figure out how do you bootstrap, a messaging graph from the beginning, how do you create this new way for people to send messages back and forth? We really saw the opportunity being, all right, people are going to be communicating across all these different apps and surfaces. How do we make that better? And when we thought about this language that we're building, languages ultimately, you want to be able to use everywhere. You want to be able to use them across all the different, contexts in which you're communicating. And so we never thought about building a messenger because that just wasn't in the DNA of the mission and the vision, which is to build this expression service that people could use everywhere. I would say in some ways the mission and vision from the beginning was the opposite of that, which was how do we bring this everywhere people are, as opposed to how do we build a walled garden ecosystem around just this content or experience.
And that's why then partnerships became a natural for you. The first one was with who?
Let me see. Who was our first partner? Actually, I think our first partner was, I think, a company called Flexi. It was a, an Android-focused keyboard. And they had seen our success on iOS and were interested in, integrating a really strong experience. And, I think they, heard our vision that, hey, we're fundamentally a, trying to build a, service, a layer, a communication expression layer, and integrated, our search engine. And, from there, we then started partnering with, other players like, Facebook, for example, was one of the other big inflection points. There was an initial messenger platform launch that didn't work all that well because it still involved friction and switching. I don't know if you remember back in 2015, but you could build an app for the Facebook Messenger platform, but the problem is that consumers would still have to switch out of the app and switch into another context.
I don't
context.
Remember that. No.
It's since been been deprecated in favor of what was successful, which was a native button built into Messenger. And so that was another big inflection point for us. And then from there, that created this domino effect where effectively all the different communication, entertainment applications felt like they needed to support this format because of the groundswell of consumer adoption. In fact, one of the reasons Facebook reached out to us was they saw our success on iOS. They saw that consumer pull and that consumer behavior. And they said, okay, well, people really love using this experience within the context of iOS and iMessage, and they're using Tenor's GIF keyboard in Facebook properties like Messenger. And they said, okay, well, we need to support this consumer behavior, and we need to figure out how to make it easier. So I would say, think about it as sort of a snowball that picked up volume and momentum as it rolled downhill. The thing that put the snowball into place was that initial Tenor iOS GIF keyboard launch, and then the adoption kept building. I kept being this groundswell moment where consumers were, really asking for the service everywhere.
Why'd you sell?
It's a complicated question. I would say, at a high level, as you sort of from the beginning when you asked me, very very mission vision driven team, and we're really excited about continuing to scale and build the service to make it even better and more useful and ultimately continue scaling and bringing it to more and more people. And so it was really driven around that sort of excitement in continuing to invest and scale in the service.
So they were going to help you go bigger with this idea.
Yeah, at a high level, really continue to dramatically and invest in it.
All right, this is it's amazing. It's amazing that you were able to make the transition from video the way that you seemed like. I think for many people, myself included, when you set out on a mission to fix video and you have a vision for how video should work, you want to just keep pursuing it, but you were able to transition. I think you said it's because of Eric, your co-founder, who said, this is the way the world is going. Let's forget about set-top boxes. Let's forget about long-form video. Let's understand this new thing. Is Eric still at Google with you? He is.
Yeah, he's still working with me.
All right. Where are you now? What part of the Bay Area? Where are you located today?
I'm down in the peninsula. I used to be up in San Francisco, which is great. You know, love the walkability of the city and so forth. But I thought I'd try something new for a little bit.
Are you liking it? I think my wife's against it because it feels too much like the suburbs. But
it's mixed. It's mixed. I said at the very beginning I was going to give it at least a year. I think, you know, what I love about San Francisco is the energy, right? That, you know, you can walk, to the Ferry Building, the Blue Bottle there. You can walk the Blue Bottle in South Park and you hear people talking about other deals and investments. And so I love that sense of energy. You get a little bit of that down here. I mean, obviously there's a large venture ecosystem that's built on Sand Hill Road. So when you go to the Phil's in Palo Alto, you get a little bit of energy. But it feels like a much higher concentration of that in San Francisco. So I do miss that. I could definitely see myself going back up there in, you know, a year, 2 years.
I'm thinking New Zealand. Do you see how good they have it in New Zealand? They might have whipped this COVID thing.
Yeah. Certainly a beautiful place to go.
Yeah, I've never been.
Although probably removed from the entrepreneurial energy.
Yeah. And you know what you told me before we started, you're making some investments. I went to your AngelList profile. They're like two VC firms, if I remember right, that you're part of.
I'm a LP, so, you know, limited partner investor in probably half a dozen, more than half a dozen, venture firms. I haven't done individual investments, primarily just because of time. I feel like if you're going to do angel investing, you need to spend a lot of time on it because you need to make a lot of investments. If you expect to break even, you need to invest in 30, 40, 50 companies. And I just don't have the time to figure out what 50 companies do I want to invest in. So I fear that it's a better use of my time to invest in firms that I believe in and people that I've worked with in the past and sort of empower them to make the decisions on where to allocate capital.
Yeah, I can see you're all in on Tenor. It's impressive to see how far you've taken this company. And thank you so much for just being here. Before we got started, I asked you, what's a win for you? How do I make this worth your while? And you just said, I'm at a point in my life now where I can help. I listened before. I want to help by giving back to people who are entrepreneurs who are building. There's no big upside for you. And I appreciate that you've given us all the upside. Thanks so much, David McIntosh. And I want to thank the two sponsors who made this interview happen. The first, you guys know, I've said this for years. If you want to hire now more than ever, go to toptal.com/mixergy. And now that this interview is over, go check out the podcast I've been talking about. It's Traffic Secrets. And whatever you're listening to me on, you can just type in Traffic Secrets and start off there. Thank you. Thank you, David.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks. Bye, everyone.